everyone, and welcome to our second episode of Orphaned Entertainment. My name is Christopher, and I am joined once again by the lovely Lydia.
Yay. I'm going to be monosyllabic for, you know, to start with. It'll get better, I promise.
Good. Thanks. I appreciate it. So what'd you think of it? It was cool.
Yeah, pretty much great. Thrilled.
Thrilled. Well, Lydia, thank you for joining me again. As I said, this is Orphan Entertainment, exploring the vast recesses of public domain media. Our first episode, we did a fun one from the 80s. This time around, we decided to go way back, back to where a lot of the films in public domain reside, back into the 30s. This particular one, 1935's Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps. And this was actually Lydia's suggestion. She came across this on archive.org. And
actually,
Lydia, I'm glad you did.
Yeah, actually, I came across this well before archive.org. But I honestly couldn't tell you when or where. I just know I must have seen it more than a decade ago. And I didn't realize it was orphaned, obviously, when I saw it. But it's a great film. I love it.
Yeah, this was the first time I had seen it. I had never seen The 39 Steps. I, of course, had heard of it, but never got around to watching it. And so I'm really glad you suggested it because, yes, this is a fun film. This was really neat to watch.
It really isn't. I mean, it's from Alfred Hitchcock's pre-American years, you know, pre-USA years. And he kind of, I feel like he did some really different things before he came to the U.S. as opposed to after he came to the U.S. You know, he's known, of course, as, like, you know, kind of the father of horror and before that, you know, before he came to the U.S. and started doing all the stuff that, of course, he's really famous for, he had a number of these kind of British spy World War II movies that most people aren't familiar with, but are really, I think, really entertaining, and most of them are kind of romantic, actually.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm one of the the Americans that know very little of Hitchcock outside of things like Psycho and mm-hmm. The Birds and that type of thing. Very little experience in watching some of the, I guess as you put it, the pre-American films.
Mm-hmm.
I believe this film was actually one of his first international successes, if I'm not mistaken.
I can only tell you what I know of it personally. So there's a good chance that it had some names in it that I think were fairly well known at the time and around that time mm-hmm. that most of us don't recognize anymore, which is really too bad.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to even do this podcast is because I knew so many films that were made back in the 30s and 40s, you know, were just lying around. They've just sort of been not so much orphaned but forgotten,
mm-hmm.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
And, I mean, these are orphaned strictly by time. The copyrights just literally ran out, and I still consider them orphaned because I think, you know, in today's world of litigation and lawyers and all this, if someone really wanted to, they could claim ownership of these films.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the studio's names are all over them. It's not as if there's, you know, we haven't found some lost films that nobody has any name on. It's just,
exactly.
You know, something nobody's taken the time to go back and reclaim, basically.
Right. And so that's why I still consider them orphaned. And this, yeah, this is one. I mean, you actually said that you have this on DVD, correct?
You know, I said I do. It turns out this movie has a sister film called Secret Agent.
Ah.
And that's the one I actually have on DVD. This one I have on another media, or medium, I should say. but I've had it probably in my collection for over a decade. And I guess it's fair to say I downloaded it because I'm not going to get sued for it because it's orphaned.
That's right.
But hey,
I downloaded it. I did the same thing. Yes.
Yes. But I've had it for, you know, probably a decade. And I don't know if you're aware of this, though. I suspect you must be. They did remake it recently.
Yeah. I believe there was I had the year in front of me. I would think it was.
It's 2008.
Yeah. Okay. 2008. Yeah. And I also understand that, I should mention 39 Steps. The film is based loosely on a novel by the same name. And if I read correctly, the 2008 version is said to be actually the closest to the book of the two or three films that have been made.
Really? Mm-hmm. I didn't actually know that.
Yeah, so which makes me very curious to actually see the 2008 version.
I liked it. I mean, it's kind of one of those, if you've ever seen The Day of the Triffids, The Day of the Triffids, there's the 1980s version, and then there's the remake with DeGray Scott, who of course I love, but it's kind of similar. I mean, the storyline's a little bit different, but they both hold up extremely well. I admit I like the 1935 version of the 39 Steps a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just because it's really from that era where it takes place in the time frame that it's talking about. Whereas the remake, obviously, you know, it's going back to that time period, but it's a modern film, so it still has that feeling of being modern.
Gotcha.
And so the interaction between the characters is a little bit more modern. You don't get that feeling of it being, you know, very period that you get, because obviously the one made in 1935 wasn't period, it was contemporary to that time.
Right. Yeah, that's something I think people forget when they watch a period piece. I don't think it's anything anyone does consciously, but filmmakers, I think, probably can't help but put kind of modern embellishments mm-hmm. to the script or the acting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is intentional. I think they do it to appeal to a modern audience. And I think that discredits the modern audience a little bit because, I mean, people who love films are going to love a film if it's well made, if they're going to love it if it's 50 years old or if it's 5 years old. But, you know, kind of the modern attitude to it is, oh, you have to appeal to the youngest generation, you know, to the common denominator of modern, you know, common modern day denominator. And I don't think that's really fair. I mean, obviously, we're doing this podcast because we believe and expect that there are people out there that are interested in this type of film. And I think there are. I think, you know, again, if it's a well-made film, it's like a well-made song, it's going to hold up over time.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if some of the lines may seem a little corny.
Contemporary. It's contemporary.
It's contemporary for the, yeah, exactly. It is contemporary for 1935. And though some of it may seem a little, really? By today's standards, I think you have to appreciate it just because, like you said, it's well done, it's well acted, and there's a lot of charm to this film, and I think that kind of goes with Alfred Hitchcock a little bit too. Mm-hmm. I think he managed, and not to just single him out as like he's the only one that ever did it, but he
right.
he does put a lot of charm in his films, or with the characters in his films.
Well, you see a lot of things that he does in his films that we see now that have been done so much that we don't even think about them. But there's a shot where they're driving away in a car, and the car drives across the screen, and then it, you know, the camera actually turns and follows the rear window of the car, and it was I kind of saw that and was like, oh, at first I thought it was a shot where it came out the rear window of the car. And at that point in time, they didn't have the technology to do that because, of course, there was no CG.
Right.
You know, in cutting film, they had to actually manually cut the film and, you know, basically paste it together to get the cuts right. But, I mean, I felt like he was trying to do in that shot what we do now with CG, where you come back through the car and the car drives away and it feels like the camera comes right out the back window. So a lot of the stuff that he does in this film, I feel like, you know, modern filmmakers have used, and we use it without even realizing that at some point some person had to come up with that shot. Somebody had to say, well, let's have it pan across the car and then come out the rear window, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things that sort of, I won't say it surprised me, because I knew that I was going to find this in some of these older films. And this is also another reason why I wanted to do this podcast, to explore these older films, is that there is so much of what you were just saying, that the basis of the films we see today were the foundation were mm-hmm. in these movies.
We started back here, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we started back here. When I was watching this movie, I got the feeling, I was like, oh my gosh, this feels like The Bourne Identity or something.
It does. I mean, it is. It's the predecessor to all of the spy films that we've ever watched. I don't know that this is the original spy film. I'm sure it's not the original spy movie, but, you know, it's one of the early ones. And so a lot of what we see, there's so many shots that you see that to me are technically interesting. Technically? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They have technical.
Technically and literally.
Yeah, literally. But they have some technical interest because I feel like Alfred Hitchcock especially, and he gets a lot of credit for telling kind of shocking stories, but I don't know... whether or not, I have to be honest, I don't know whether or not he gets a lot of credit for telling stories well. He must. I mean, you know, I can think of, you know, tons of shots in films or moments in films, really, where he does something unexpected. Not unexpected because it's, I mean, now we think of it as being so natural, you know, but but back then, you know, I'm tangenting, I think.
No, you're right. And this film is not removed from that. There are a couple moments that back in 1935, it had to be a little bit surprising. I mean, we'll get to it. Well, actually, I think maybe let's start talking about the film itself.
Good idea. I'm trying not to give too much away before we get to those points, but maybe it's a good time to move on.
Yep, absolutely. So let's start talking about the film, kind of going through the plot a little bit here. I don't know, you know, last time we went through the plot, we went through a lot of the plot and went through the movie. So
Pretty great detail, yeah.
Very, very finite detail. I don't know if that is necessarily necessary with these things, but I do want to go through, because there are, I'm sure we want to go through and we'll talk about certain shots, or we want to talk about moments or lines or the characters themselves. So we'll try to hit all the highlights. And if we end up going through in as minute detail as before, forgive us. If we don't, well, I encourage you to go and watch the film and fill in the blanks.
Like if you stop listening to the podcast right now and go watch the film, then this podcast will not have been wasted.
Absolutely. All right, well, the 39 Steps, the film opens up at a music hall, a vaudeville act in London, with the great Mr. Memory performing. This is a man who, you know, commits facts to memory, like I think they said 50 facts a day.
And 50 every day, yep.
Every day, and he can repeat them verbatim, you can ask him anything. So it's essentially just a sideshow. A sideshow, thank you.
Yeah.
And our star of the film, Mr.
Robert Donat.
Richard Hannay. Thank you. It's an odd name. That's why I kind of stumbled for a minute, because he used the names Hammond later on in the film, and that's what sticks in my head.
Now, does he actually say, because if you look at the credits, if you look at the credits on IMDb, it just says Hannay, but I know it's Richard because I've seen the 2008 version of it. But I guess it's just Hannay. I guess they just call him that through this whole film.
Yeah, I don't think we ever see his first name. We might see his first initial on like his apartment, on the placard on his apartment or something, which may have been an R. I'd have to go back and look.
I'd have to too.
Yeah, so Mr. Hannay. He's taken in the show. He's in London. We see the prowess of Mr. Memory's brain as he spits out a few facts. Some really kind of fun little lines here and there. Some really good crowd heckling going on. It opens up with really kind of a fun scene, because this is, again, one of these little things where you wonder how many of these people were just, hey, we're going to film something in here, could you come in here and just, you know, we'll give you a beer.
Wonder if it was done with extras the way we do it with extras now, where they just grab people off the street almost.
Yeah, exactly.
But they do, and they have some good heckling in this. It goes through a little bit quickly, so you miss a lot of it.
Yeah, it's hard to miss. And I don't know about your copy. Unfortunately, the downloaded copy that I have, some of the sound was a little crummy. I'm sure there's got to be better versions out there. But my sound kept kind of going up and down. I'd have to crank it up to hear a little bit, and then I'd be blown back in my chair and have to turn it back down, and then I'd miss something and turn it back up. And so
I think a lot of that is actually going to be the sound quality on the film, because, I mean, bear in mind, this is a 1935 movie. Mm-hmm. It's not – they didn't have the level of technology that we have now to, you know, equalizers and all of that to – kind of smooth everything out. So on mine too, you get some loud moments. There are a couple of words that kind of just get, I think, almost lost in the tape. I think the tape is just corroded or degraded. But the dialogue in this though is good. It's not, you know, the funny parts go a little bit quick, but it is funny. It has its humorous stuff.
Kind attention and permission, I have the honor of presenting to you one of the most remarkable men in the world.
How remarkable? He's sweaty.
And can you be surprised at that, gentlemen? Every day he commits to memory 50 new facts and remembers every one of them. Facts from history, from geography, from newspapers, from scientific books, millions and millions of them. Think of the strain involved by his prodigious feats.
His feet ain't half as big as yours, Cully.
I'm referring to his feats of memory.
Oh.
Test him, please. Ladies and gentlemen, ask him your questions, and he will answer you fully and freely. Mr. Memory.
What won the Derby in 1921?
Mr. Jack Jones, humorist, with Steve Donoghue, won a length at the odds of 6-1. Second and third, Craig and Aaron and Lemonora. Am I right, sir?
Right.
What won in 1936?
You come back in 1937 and I'll tell you, sir.
What won the Cup in 1926?
Cup? Waterloo, football or tea, sir?
Football, silly.
Winning.
63 BC in the presence of the Emperor Nero.
What causes flipping poultry?
Shh, don't make yourself so common.
Well, our bells are funny, haven't they?
Who was the last British heavyweight champion of the world?
Henry VIII. My old woman.
Bob Fitzsimmons. He defeated Jim Corbett, heavyweight champion of America, at Carson City, Nevada, in October 1897. He was then 34 years of age, sir. Am I right, sir?
How old is my wife?
I know, sir, but I never tell a lady's age. Next, please.
Drink. How far is Winnipeg from Montreal?
Ah, a gentleman from Canada. You're welcome, sir. Winnipeg, the third city of Canada and the capital of the province of Manitoba. Distance from Montreal, 1,424 miles. Am I right, sir?
Quite right.
Next, please. Of course, that was a very historical fact.
Oh, my word!
And actually, I think that what's kind of funny that a riot almost breaks out in this. And one of the things you hear over and over is the same guy screaming, "How old is Mae West?"
And then there's the guy he's asking, "How do chickens get some kind of disease or something like that?" You've got the farmer. You never find out, but
yeah.
And then that all gets ended with a couple of gunshots, I believe.
Yes, you're correct. The riot breaks out. They actually to kind of step back a little bit, I thought it was really neat that they actually use this to kind of give you a little exposition of Hannay. He's not a Londoner. He's from Canada.
He is.
Because he comes in, he asks some question about how far it is from some town to Montreal. And
like Toronto to Montreal, I
something,
think.
Something, yeah. Mr. Member's like, "Oh, yeah, where are you from? Canada? Oh, you're welcome." And he gives them the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like it when they do that, where they don't have the let me stand here and tell you the story, but it's actually kind of weaved into what's going on.
In the exposition,
The exposition, exactly. That's another a little bit of art form that is often lost, I think, in modern films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the bad ones.
Yeah. You usually get the guy coming up and go, "Hello, I'm Hannay. I'm from Canada."
Canada, yeah. Oh, yeah. Nice to meet you, Mr. Hannay.
Hannay from Canada,
In this case, they try and do it. Again, I think that's part of the charm that Hitchcock has that we don't recognize him as much for as we should.
Yeah, it makes everything's very natural.
Mm-hmm.
Between the people, and when he gives you the exposition, it's done in a natural way. But yes, there is a fight of some sort, a riot sort of breaks out, and two shots are fired. Mr. Hannay makes it out and manages to kind of scoop up a mysterious woman along the way, who just out of nowhere asks him, "Could you please take me home with you?
Can I go home with you?"
Again, this film would drastically depart in a modern cinema.
Yeah, I totally would. Yeah, and I think he says, "Oh, it's your funeral," and takes her with him. They hop on a bus.
Mm-hmm. For any Hitchcock fans, if you want to know, I don't know if you want to spoil the Hitchcock sighting in this one.
I didn't even realize.
Yeah, apparently it is actually right there about that scene when they hop on the bus. You can see Alfred Hitchcock in the background littering.
I'm going to have to watch it again now. Because I knew that he had made a point to be in every one of his films try in almost every one of his films. But it didn't occur to me that he was doing that before he came over to the U.S.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was something he picked up later in his career or not. And I'll admit I didn't know until I started reading a little bit more about the film online and through a couple sources that was the case, and that's where he was, and like, oh, very cool. So
interesting.
Yep. But they make it back to Mr. Hannay's apartment. We discover that he is apparently only here, apparently just recently moved to London from Canada, and is only going to be staying for a short time. His apartment is still covered in sheets, furniture everywhere. And this woman is very mysterious, hiding from the windows, wants him to turn the mirror. Very eccentric, I guess, would be the word.
or just suspicious acting, yeah.
Yeah, and he just kind of takes it all in stride. He's a very interesting character.
I know, you would almost think he's British.
Yes, you'd think.
almost.
Almost.
English, sorry, English listeners. yeah, but he just goes with it, which I think, again, that's a really kind of English facet to personality. So maybe Canadians are as reserved as the British are, and we just don't realize it.
Or at least they were in 1935.
But yeah, so she, so I think at some point, you know, she says, he asks her who she is, and she says, Miss Smith, is that right?
Yes, I think she gives Annabelle Smith.
Annabella Smith,
and she apparently admits to firing the shots because she had to get out of there because someone was after her.
Two men following her, yeah. Yes. And she's got that accent, which I would love to be able to do, but I can't.
Yes, I'm not
What is it,
try.
Austrian or something like that?
Yeah, some sort of Germanic, Austrian, something along those lines. She claims to be a freelance spy, and there's enemy agents after her because she knows something.
Oh, and the phone starts ringing.
Yes.
And she says, I'd rather you not answer that. And he says, why not? And she says, because I think it's for me.
Yeah, that's a great line.
And you kind of go, wait a minute. Why is somebody calling his house asking for her? So you kind of, you kind of start realizing that this, he kind of chuckles it off, but.
Yes, he's like, all right then, would you like a drink?
Right. Since we're here. Yeah. Oh, and I think she says, it's not safe to talk in here. You know, and they go in the kitchen. I'm not sure why the kitchen is safer to talk in than the living room.
No windows, maybe.
Well, she pulls down the blinds. That is true.
Oh, that's right. Curtains. There was a windows, yes, but
yeah,
she pulls down the blinds.
Yeah, but he comments on not having any curtains on that room, so they move on to the kitchen where there's a blind. And she says one of my favorite lines in the whole film. She says, I'm going to tell you something which is not very healthy to know. I think that's it's just such a great line. It's, you know, rather than saying I'm going to tell you something, but it's dangerous, just something that's not very healthy to know.
Yes, and that she gives him talks of the 39 steps. Doesn't explain what it is, but apparently it's very important, and men will kill.
Men will kill to protect it. Yeah, whatever it is.
I really appreciate that. Of course, he is very polite in not believing her. But she finds, go look out the window. And he does and sees a shadowy figure under a lamp.
Mm, men what are those called? The coats, the overcoats.
Oh, yes, the big overcoats.
Trench coats. That's
trench coat, there you go.
Men in trench coats.
And that is enough to make him believe that she's telling the truth, which, okay.
Well, I mean, you know, it's 1935. How often are men in trench coats hanging out around light posts outside of people's apartments?
Yeah, I don't know how things worked back then. I don't know when the buses stopped,
Yeah. I think the buses kept going until, 1939?
Well, I mean, you know, there must be
at night.
At night, you know, yeah. He could have been waiting for the bus, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so he believes her, and I think she says, do you mind if I stay here? And he says, you can sleep in my bed. I'll take the sofa.
Yes, how does he put it? I love the way he put it. I'll have a shakedown on the couch.
Is that what he says? A shakedown on the couch.
Yeah. Just a great little bit of vernacular. You don't get it. You don't get today.
Yeah, again, I mean, this is part of watching a film that was made, you know, gosh, how many years ago? I'm horrible with math. 70 years? 80 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Almost 70 years.
Almost 70.
Yes.
It's like reading a book that was written in England. You're going to get a little bit different vocabulary than you get here.
Absolutely, but it's still a lot of fun to kind of catch it, and sometimes you have to sit there and think, what does he mean?
Why did they say that?
Yes, but she does mention that there's a man that runs or that's involved with the 39 steps that is apparently not a good man to know. He's a man with many names and even more faces, but he can't hide that he's missing a joint from his pinky.
his community.
He's got a short pinky.
So that's the only way that we know to recognize this guy.
Exactly.
So, you know, I feel like a little bit like we're searching for Count Rogan. The man with the six-fingered hand. And
oh, right. Thank you.
Sorry. Oh, I know the name. Sorry. The six-fingered man, you know. You wouldn't happen to have six fingers on your right. You wouldn't happen to be missing a joint off of your pinky, would you? You always begin conversations this way. But I mean, in this case, that's the only way that we really know. I don't think she gives him any names and doesn't give him any kind of descriptor, just that.
Nope, that's it. Just, he's got the missing piece of his pinky. That's all we know. So they go ahead and crash, and then in the middle of the night, he is woken by Annabelle storming into the room with a very large knife sticking out of her back.
And she says, what does she say? Get out, Hannah, before they get you, too, or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly.
And collapses with a knife in her back.
Which makes me think, you know, if they really wanted him dead, wouldn't he be already?
Yeah, well, and I thought about that this time that I was watching it. Maybe they just expected him to be kind of a louse and be in the bed with her. And when he wasn't in the bed with her, maybe they figured that he'd already, you know, kind of scampered off or something.
See, my actual thought was they would have, and they almost succeeded, used him as a scapegoat.
Yeah, well, I mean, that
if they leave him alive, obviously, he's the one that killed her.
Yeah, of course. But then the other interesting thing about that, and this to me, when it happened this most recent time when I was watching it, I just, you know, it was like, oh, really scary is the phone rings as soon as he gets up off the couch. You know, she falls dead and he gets off the couch and the phone rings. And I thought, man, that's scarier than the ring. Like, to have somebody fall dead at your feet and then the phone rings, that's way scarier than, you know, finishing a video and then the phone ringing. But
and not through anything other than that's just the way the phone is, but it's a mean sounding ring.
It really is. Well, and I mean, it makes you wonder too. I mean, when they were making the ring, did they watch this and go, "Ooh, that'd be really scary"?
Yeah,
the phone rang right after something horrible happened. But yeah, this to me was way scarier. You know, if you know that somebody's been in your apartment and all of a sudden your phone rings, it's in your apartment killing somebody.
Right. But again, he remains incredibly calm under the circumstances. Again, it's the British or the Canadian in him, I guess.
Yeah.
The whole time the phone rings. I love the fact that their phone continues to ring the entire scene. There's no dialogue. Yeah. And it's just the phone. Is all you hear is ringing and ringing. But he, from her dead hand, he takes a map of Scotland that apparently he had provided her, and there's a small town circled on it, and he
that
knows
nobody
that this
can
is
pronounce.
Yes, Altnashalock.
Yeah. Oh, you wrote it down. I couldn't.
I wrote it down.
I didn't. I thought I'm not even going to try. A little town in Scotland. That's what I'll call it.
Yeah, little town in Scotland, where he thinks that perhaps her contact. That's maybe where she was heading. And her contact may be there, and so he wants to, he sets off to try to find this person to, I guess, I don't know what he thinks he's going to do other than tell her, hey, your friend Annabelle is dead, and I don't know anything that she wanted to tell you, but that's right. What he does.
Well, and this is one of my favorite shot, or my favorite scenes in the film, is when he's trying to get out of his apartment, and the guys are outside of the door.
Mm-hmm.
And and you know, he's waiting for them to leave, and of course they're not going to leave because, you know, upstairs the phone is still ringing off the hook. And the milkman comes in, and he starts telling the milkman, you know, you've got to help me. There's a dead woman up in my apartment. There are two guys outside. They're waiting to kill me. And the milkman's like, oh, come on, you know, whatever, you're crazy, you know. And you know, because she's already told him, Annabelle has told him, you know, nobody's going to believe you, just like you don't believe me. And so he tells the milkman, all right, you got me. There's a married woman upstairs, and her husband is outside the door.
Right.
And I'm trying to speak out. And
yo, why didn't you say so? I only wanted to be told.
Sure, I'll help you. I'm a married milkman, but I'll help you get out the door, no problem.
Yeah.
But again, it's one of those, I think it shows really the humor that Hitchcock does. And I think all of his films have these little moments of humor, just kind of so they don't get too heavy-handed. But the way he covers them, again, it's always very natural. It's not, you know, you don't have wooden actors trying to get through a scene just to make sense out of a film. But you have this kind of really natural play, you know, between a British guy that's not going to believe a Canadian that, you know, there's some dead person upstairs. He'd rather, you know, we kind of lie to ourselves. We'd rather believe that it's, oh, some guy that's, you know, fooling around with another guy's wife.
Right.
Did that make any sense? I feel like I just went off on another tangent.
Nope, I think you did great.
You might have to do a lot of editing on this one.
I'm just no. This is edit free.
Oh, dear God.
Okay, maybe minor.
But I love that episode, or that part of the, I love that part of the film. I just think it's another one of those humorous little moments that I appreciate.
Yep. No, I loved it too. I was definitely wanted to point that scene out because that was a lot of fun. And it ends. I just loved, you know, he gets the guy's coat and hat and he heads out. And then the last line, hey, the empties.
The empties. Leave. What does he say? Park the pony around the corner.
Right. Yeah. I'll get it later. Thanks.
Park the pony around the corner. I love that.
Yep. But I think he ends up taking the pony all the way to the train station.
Oh, does he? Oh no!
I don't know if he really does. The next shot you see is the train station.
The train station, yeah.
Yeah.
With the pony outside, that's true. I didn't think of that.
Yeah. So I did. That's what made me think is like, oh, there is actually a cart and horse right outside. So like,
right.
did he just go ahead and take that all the way to the station?
Hilarious. Oh, but, and this is another one, which is another one of my favorite shots. That, you know, like I was talking about with the car going by, this is, so, you know, he's, how exactly does this go? He's at the train station and, this is a pretty short scene, isn't it? Where he gets on the train and you kind of see him and then you see the two guys run out.
Yeah.
And I love this scene, the shot, because it shows, you know, the train starts moving and Hanny's looking behind him, you know, looking at these two guys that, you know, see him and they point and they start running toward the train. And this is a really classic Hitchcock shot, I think, where you see it's like tracking along the pavement and you see the shadow of the train and the guy's feet chasing it and the shadow pulls away. And
right.
So the two guys that are chasing it. It's so great because he's not showing, you know, just a straight on shot of the train and the guys chasing it and missing it. It's for some reason it's so much more poignant because you don't see their faces. You're left to imagine it.
Yeah, and I think too, I have to imagine that shots like this, although they come across really well, they were probably done mainly for budgetary reasons and for making it just simpler. It's like, okay, we can't really time the guys with the actual train leaving, so you imagine there's some guy with a cutout of a train walking in like the shadow.
I hadn't even thought of that.
I imagine.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's a great shot. You're just, you know, left to imagine everything. But yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah.
All budgetary constraints. Oh, I'm so disappointed now.
No, I don't think you should be budgetary or should be disappointed. And it may be not necessarily budgetary. It just may, we need to make this as simple as we can. And instead of trying to time, like I said, time with the train and get to the people and get the camera to pan, you know, it's probably all easier. They could do it in studio. Rather than on a train station somewhere.
I hadn't even thought of that.
Yeah.
Not as smart as I sound. But I am as cute as I sound. So, just kidding.
Moving on.
Yeah, edit.
Yeah. There's another really great shot that, again, it's one of those things that you see in films after this plenty, and maybe you've seen it in before, but the discovery of the body. It's just, again, a really quick scene. Apparently the cleaning lady or something is in his apartment, and she opens the door and sees the woman lying on the floor, and she turns to scream, and you hear the train whistle. It's an immediate cut to the train. And I thought that's just fun. I like it when they do that.
Mm-hmm. You're going to laugh at this, but what it reminded me of was Scary Movie 3, where she's searching on the internet and when she sees the lighthouse, and then it, like, I don't know, she's like looking closer and closer, and then the sound of like a fairy horn, and it like cuts to the fairy going across, and it's the fairy horn, but it startles her while she's like looking at the screen, like the horn sounds. Anyway, never mind. It's just, but again, I think it's one of those things that they used a lot, and you kind of are left to wonder, did that come from this film or one of its predecessors? Like, where does this trick come from?
Yeah, exactly. It'd be amazing to try to track, and you wonder if it's one of these things that, was it really invented by one person, or was it one of these things that just kind of materialized from a lot of filmmakers without one really knowing what the other was doing, and you know, that sort of thing.
You know, was it an advent of the silent film era when it was all just sound effects or music?
Yeah, good question. It'd be an amazingly hard task to do, but it would be very interesting to kind of track some of this stuff back. But he's on the train with a couple, I love the lady undergarment salesman. Sitting across from on the train, and they're doing the he pulls out the corset. Oh, my wife. Oh, but look at this one, and they got the pretty silk, and It's a lot of fun. The guy off the other side is just obviously not enjoying their conversation. Again, just this really nice little character moments with people. Mm-hmm. Whether they're important to the plot or not, you don't know, and it doesn't matter. And yeah. I really love that.
Well, and I think you're right. As far as you don't always know. It's nice because you're kind of left wondering what's going to happen next. You're not led through the strict progression of events. You have a little bit of stuff thrown in on the side to kind of keep you guessing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are these two guys that are on the train? Are they, you know, because Hannah is asleep when we come to the scene. So are these two guys? Are they spies? Do they know who he is? Are they, you know, is it just, you know, kind of a fluke that these guys don't know anything about him, or do they know who he is, and is he being, you know, stalked, or what's going on here?
Exactly. He notices he asked to borrow one of their paper, and he's reading the paper, and he's reading an article about the murder that took place in his apartment, mm-hmm. that he's being sought after for questioning, and they do that shot where he's looking at the guy over the paper. You see the paper, mm-hmm. and you see his eyes, and he's staring at him. The other guy seems to be staring back at him, but it's like, you don't know. You're thinking the same thing Hannah is does he know? You know, mm-hmm. does he suspect
so
anything?
Have I
been caught? You know, and it even brings him to the point that at a stop, he gets out, and you think for just a moment, he walks up to an officer, and you have to think he's going to just turn himself in,
mm-hmm.
and try to explain everything. And there just happens to be an offhanded comment by someone else talking to the officer, reading the paper, like, oh, with that kind of evidence, they'll hang anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, never mind.
Maybe not. Maybe we'll get back on the train for now. Yeah. Which leads him to finally meet the femme fatale of the film.
Yes, exactly. He's on the train, and apparently the police have boarded the train and are searching the cars. And he tries the old jump into the room and give her a kiss while the police go by trick. And
yeah, which we've seen work hundreds of times.
Yes.
It's worked every time I've seen it until
this film.
Well, you know, and when I'm running from somebody, I just grab a random guy and kiss him on the street, and whoever's chasing me just goes on by.
That's right.
But we got it from this film.
Exactly, apparently. It doesn't work in this film, though. The police do finally kind of knock in, excuse me, have you seen anyone come by here? And she's, yes, how about this guy right here?
Yeah. Yeah, this is the one. Yeah, well, and this is, I want to take a quick second and talk about Madeline Carroll.
Sure.
She is in Secret Agent, which is the one that I was talking about,
that
I think may also be orphaned. And then, and she went on to do a couple of big name films, but this seems to be kind of the first major one that she was in.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, but other one that she did, I want to find out if this is orphaned or not, but it's called The Prisoner of Zenda. It's a great film.
Yeah, not sure about that one.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, it's not, she was in quite a few things, but this, I think, was the first one where she turned out, I guess they call her the icy blonde or the frozen blonde femme fatale or something like that.
We'll have to check that, because Secret Agent is 1936 and The Prisoner of Zenda is 1937, so they're all old enough to be orphans, whether or not, like I was saying, whether anyone with a decent lawyer hung on to any of them.
Right.
Or these could be lying around, so these may be films to look forward to in the future.
And she was in, and I know this one's not orphaned, there's no way, My Favorite Blonde with Bob Hope.
Oh, yeah. I guarantee you with anything with Bob Hope.
But it's interesting because, you know, it's not a name that we recognize that much, but she's in quite a number of things.
Yeah, very.
And really enjoyable to watch, I think.
Yeah, she does fantastic in this film. And we'll, you know, we think that this is just sort of a brief meeting of a character, because this moment, it's only a few minutes, because Hannah makes a daring escape out the outside door of the train car and shimmies along to the next door to get in and tries to escape from the police, and does manage to get off the train and hide on a bridge.
Which, of course, it's against regulations. They can't stop the train on a bridge, so the conductor says we've got to get moving, and Hanny is saved because of train regulations.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. Whew.
Yeah, and again, I mean, I hate to sit here and keep kind of like comparing to modern films, but this, I mean, he makes this daring escape and he gets on the train, but I'm thinking, you know, if it were today, there would definitely be a fight scene.
Yeah, you're right. I can't imagine Daniel Craig getting off that train without punching several people and possibly shooting someone.
Exactly. You start to wonder, like, as much as entertaining as this film is, would that have helped it? And I'm thinking, no. This was fine the way it was.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Well, especially in Britain. Nobody fights in Britain.
That's true.
Even the police don't have guns there, you know?
Stop, or I'll say stop again.
Exactly. Yeah. But he does get away.
Yes.
And takes off across the Scottish moors, I believe.
Yeah, he makes it to a farmhouse, apparently not too far from the little town in Scotland, where he meets a young wife of a farmer who they...
Proctor, they call it, yeah.
Yes, they take him in for a night. Farmer is already very suspicious of him.
And creepy.
And rather creepy, yeah. He's apparently much older. You get the male impression this was an arranged marriage or a mail-order bride of some sort.
And I think that Hannah asks him, he says, oh, is this your daughter? And he says, it's my wife.
Yeah, and I think Hannah talks to her. I get the impression she may actually have been from London or at least a larger town.
I think she says Glasgow.
Glasgow, okay. That makes sense there in Scotland.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. one of the large cities in Scotland.
Yeah, but somehow or another, she has managed to find her way to be a wife of an older farmer.
Mm-hmm.
Again, nothing that is terribly important to the plot, but still just fun little interesting character bits.
Mm-hmm. You kind of find out about... You find a little bit out about Hannah. You find out that he's really genuinely a good guy. He's nice. He's kind to this wife, you know, without expecting anything in return, even mm-hmm. though, you know, the farmer gets suspicious and, like, guess like older men do. I don't know. But,
yeah, I don't know.
But you know, he, even though... What really, I think the whole point to this scene is, you know, Hitchcock is drawing out the tension because, again, you've got a newspaper that is talking about, you know, this daring escape by this murderer to Scotland. And he's, you know, trying to get the paper away from him without saying, hey, don't read that paper.
Right.
You know, which would be now we'd be like, oh, don't read the paper. Here, it's got something spilled on it. Whereas there, you know, he'll like go to reach for it. And then he just like kind of.
Oh, I dropped it in the fire. Oh,
right.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
You know, so there's, you don't have those kind of. Those forced moments, it's very tense, but also kind of natural.
I do kind of question the thought process. The farmer, obviously, he notices that something's up between these two. Mm-hmm. I think during prayer over before dinner, Hannah's sort of, he can't help but keep focusing on the paper. Mm-hmm. And the wife notices this and immediately puts two and two together.
Because mm-hmm. she's smart. She's from the city. She gets
yes.
how things are.
And the farmer happens to notice these strange knowing glances between these two. And so, there's something going on between these two. I think I'll leave the room.
Right. That's what I do.
Yes.
Actually, you know what? To be fair, that is kind of what I do. But no, you know, I think the point is he doesn't really know what's going on. So he makes that kind of carnal assumption that, you know, mm-hmm. Hannah, or, you know, what's he going by in the scene? It's another
Is he using Hammond yet?
What was it?
Hammond?
Hammond.
I think he starts going by Hammond. Yeah,
that's what it is, Hammond. So I think, you know, he makes that automatic assumption that Hammond is trying for his wife.
Yeah, you know what? This was actually very cool. I don't think he even uses a name at this point, because I think the farmer... It says, I don't believe you, I don't believe I asked you your name, and no, you didn't. It was something along those lines.
Yeah, I missed that part. I was thinking
yeah.
by Hammond, but...
It reminded me of I didn't catch your name, I didn't throw it.
Right, yeah. But yeah, you know, so I think he's trying to questionable motives, let's just say that. The farmer's got questionable motives.
Yes, and he's not completely stupid. He leaves the room. He goes outside. He makes some excuse about forgetting to lock the barn. But then he sort of, you know, he spies through the windows and sees them talking and arguing. So he knows there's something going on. Doesn't know what. Something going on.
Yeah.
Apparently, the police do come wander by, and the wife certainly helps Hanoi. She trusts them, and the farmer sells him out as quick as he can.
Yeah. Even with the promise of money from Hannay, the farmer basically asks, is there a reward for it?
Yes, exactly.
And this is one of those scenes, again, where you get, even though these are minor characters, I love it that Hitchcock gives everybody like a real personality, a real kind of motive. And, you know, Hannay, he says, you know, thank you so much. I'll never forget what you did. And he grabs the wife and he gives her a quick kiss and he hurries out the door. And it doesn't end on him, you know, the camera doesn't follow him running out the door. It focuses on the wife and she just looks so sad. And you're left to think, this girl that is, you know, half the age of her husband is stuck here with this creepy old guy, you know, but she's going to stick it out even though, you can tell that she's so sad about this. It's just
right.
That she's so sad that she has the one maybe chance of running off with a guy that she would, you know, have an exciting life with is gone.
I was right. He's asking if there's a reward if you get catched. He'll argy-bargy for a moment longer before he lets them in. Now's your time. Oh, your jacket's terrible light-colored. I'm afeard they'll see you. You best take this one.
This your husband's coat?
Aye, his Sunday best one. But never mind. They mustn't see you.
What'll happen to you?
Well, I say I couldn't have stopped you.
Well, not he'll treat you.
No. He'll pray at me, but no more.
What's your name?
Margaret.
Goodbye, Margaret. I'll never forget you for this.
But there's another quick chase across the moors, and Hanoi makes it to the house of what he thinks is Annabelle's contact and interrupts a little party. Apparently the owner of the home is his daughter's birthday, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And amongst the guests is the local sheriff, which is always, you know, just who you want to bump into when you're running from a murder rap. But he quickly discovers after the party breaks up and the owner of the home comes to him and has a little talk with him, thinks he's Annabelle Smith's contact, and it turns out, and I'd really love this.
What about our mutual friend Annabella?
She's been murdered.
Murdered? Oh, the Portland Mansions affair. What our friends outside are looking for you for?
I didn't do it.
Of course you didn't. But why come all this way to Scotland to tell me about it?
I believe she was coming to see you about some Air Ministry secret. She was killed by a foreign agent who was interested, too.
Did she tell you what the foreign agent looked like?
It wasn't time. No, there was one thing. Part of his little finger was missing.
Which one?
This one, I think.
Sure it wasn't this one?
Aha! We have
in holes of his hand. One thing that I didn't really notice about this until this time watching it, if you watch all of the scenes leading up to this, up until that point, the host has his right hand in his pocket. And
yes,
so even
he does.
If you want the chance to see if that's the bad guy, you don't get the chance until he reveals it.
Mm-hmm. Did we have a name for the bad guy? I want to say they gave him a name, and I don't remember.
Well, the professor, I think, is what they call him. But Professor Jordan is the official name for it.
Okay, thank you. Jordan, thank you.
Jordan,
okay.
There you go.
Yeah, all right. But this, I loved him, and I wish we could have had more of the evil Professor Jordan, because the polite criminals are always the creepiest.
Yeah.
He is so nice the whole time. He's very polite and he's just very matter of fact.
Oh, makes the point to lead Hannay over and show him out the window. Oh, I want you to see this view of the, and you know, shows him this quote view unquote of the police being led away for their, on their search for him. You know, he says, I've sent the police away. And he's like, oh, come look at this view. We're very proud of it. And then turns out it's the same guy that he's trying to avoid that sent the police away.
But he's always, you know, so you've left me even an interesting spot. What shall I do with you? I mean, he's like the greatest, like, of the Bond villains or something. Mm-hmm. He's just really cool. Just cool, collected. It's like, okay, this guy just showed up at your door. He's got a murder up. He brought the police to your door and everything. And you're just going to sit here and talk to him and help him decide his fate.
Right. No, Mr. Hannay, I expect you to commit suicide.
Yes.
With this handy little pistol in my pocket. Yes, and here's, I think, the really kind of scary part is the wife walks in at this point when Jordan has the pistol in his pocket that he's saying, well, Hannay, you have two choices. You can shoot yourself with this gun or I can shoot you. And the wife walks in and he's holding this gun in his hand and all she says is, you know, are you almost ready, dear? We've got something else to do. And he says, oh, yes, in just a moment. You know, and she just kind of smiles and walks
out. Will Mr. Hammond be joining us? I don't think so.
Right. And you think, okay, at first you think, oh, you know, this guy's a spy. Nobody knows what's going on. And then you realize his wife walked in and saw him with a gun and doesn't even say, why why are you holding a gun? She knows what's going on, so he's not going to get any help from the women in this house.
Nope. It is. It's a fantastic little moment. And this is one of these, you were talking about these interesting little surprises that Hitchcock will throw in a film. Mr. Hannay is shot.
Yeah.
Shot essentially point blank, and the screen, the long dark fade, and you think, wait a minute. Our
that
guy just got
film.
Killed. Yeah, that was short. Yeah. Wait a minute. We're only halfway through the film. But the next scene, it opens, and Hannay is in the sheriff's office, and it is, apparently the bullet was stopped by the hymn book from the crofter. Who,
that's right. He says it cuts to them real briefly, and it just shows him, and he says, I can't find my hymn book.
Right. It was here in my Sunday coat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she says, I gave it to the man that was running away. And you don't see it, but you hear a little bit of the,
you hear a slap.
The whooping. Yeah,
yes.
The whooping that she's going to get later on.
Yes, but the hymn book saves the man's life. And they even make a point of like, oh, I've heard of, what do they call it, snuff boxes or something. Or
yeah.
Never a hymn book and not anything out of a crime novel. You know, how ridiculous this is. I really loved it, but... that's how he survives. Apparently, they went to dispose of his body, and he was able to steal the car and make it to the sheriff.
Yep.
Sheriff seems to believe his story, but it turns out he's just playing along until more policemen arrive to take him away. Scotland Yard, I guess.
Yeah, I think he's. What does he say? Detectives from the next city, the next town over.
And there's a. Another daring escape by Mr. Hannay. He actually jumps through the window, and there's a short chase through the city, and he ends up, I love it, he ends up in some sort of a political campaign rally, I think.
Yeah, a political campaign rally.
And he's mistaken for, like, the opening speaker.
Mm-hmm, the speaker to introduce the candidate, yeah.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for my hesitation in rising just now, but to tell you the simple truth, I'd entirely failed while listening to the chairman's flattering description of the next speaker to realize he was talking about me. As for you, may I say from the bottom of my heart and with the utmost sincerity how delighted and relieved I am to find myself in your presence at this moment. Delighted, because of your friendly reception. Relieved, because so long as I stand on this platform, I'm delivered from the moment, from the cares and anxieties which must always be the lot of a man in my position. When I journeyed up to Scotland a few days ago, travelling on the Highland Express over that magnificent structure, the Forth Bridge, that monument to Scottish engineering and Scottish muscle. That is to say, on that journey, I had no idea that in a few days' time I should find myself addressing an important political meeting. No idea. I'd planned a very different program for myself.
And that's just funny. He actually does a really great job. The audience loves him. I just love it. I mean, it's like, you know what? I've seen this in films since. And, like, here it is in 1935. Hmm. People, again, I feel terrible having to, maybe that's what this podcast is really about, is just
the history of film.
The history of film, showing people where all this stuff. If you thought that the first time you saw it was in 2012, I got news for you.
Yeah, totally different.
But he gives a really great speech. Doesn't know anything about the guy he's talking about, but everyone loves him. But does it manage to bump back into Pamela, the girl from the train?
Yeah, that's right. And did we even get her name before now?
No, this is we find out her name after, I think, the police catch up with them and handcuff them and take them, and they want her to come along to make some sort of statement, and I believe...
to identify him as the man
exactly.
That was in question.
Yes, and we get her name there as being Pamela. They are taken away, but Hannay gets he gets suspicious of the men taking them. They apparently pass by the closest police station and keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
And so he starts suspecting that perhaps they aren't the authorities, and maybe they are indeed the foreign agents that he needs to be worried about.
What does he say? Does your they say, we're taking you to the big man. And he says, does the big man by any chance, is he missing part of his finger? And
yes.
I think one of them just hits him in reply. They don't even answer.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But being Scotland, of course, you can't go too far without hitting a flock of sheep.
Right. Oh, I love this line, too. What is it he says? He says, oh, it's a whole flock of detectives. I love that. Again, just the you get little witty moments like that throughout the whole thing. You know, mm-hmm. if you're not paying attention, you'll miss it. But just little zingers.
Yes. The men handcuff Pamela to Hannay while they go to try to clear the road of the sheep. And then Hannay grabs her, takes her out of the car, and again, off across the moors.
Which is foggy, luckily.
Yes, fortunately. It wouldn't have worked otherwise.
No, not very well. Unless they hid in the sheep, but who wants
to
do that? But yeah, keeps her as quiet as he can, hides under the bridge, I think, or under a bridge.
Yeah, until they go off somewhere so they can make a clean escape. They make their way to some sort of a inn, a bed and breakfast, something like that, and he sells them off as a, and I love it, he calls them, we're a runaway couple.
A runaway couple, yeah. Well, and I like it too, that one of the things that you kind of, again, the moments where, you know, she's like, let me go, you're a horrible murderer, and he's like, no, I'm not, I'm innocent, you know, and they have this kind of little scuffle out on the moors, and he says, okay, fine, you're right, I'm a murderer, I kill a woman every day, you know, or every week, one woman a week or something like that. If that's what you really want to be in the situation, you know, if you want to be in that situation, then fine, that's the situation you're in. Do you feel better? And she's just kind of like, oh, just kind of subdued. But, you know, you kind of get the idea. He's totally frustrated. He's been running for, what, 4 days at this point.
Right.
And now he's handcuffed to a woman that hates him, that he kissed the first time he met, and she didn't appreciate it. So
no.
But, yeah, so they end up at this bed and breakfast or little inn. And
yes.
Convince the innkeeper's wife that they're a runaway couple and their car has crashed. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe it was something along those lines, right? Because they're wet. They're trying to, you know, they warm up across, you know, in front of the fire, trying to hide the handcuff as best
right,
they can.
Right.
But she, of course, I mean, he tries to get him out of the handcuffs, but both of them are exhausted, and I think they both pass out on the bed.
Well, interesting point about this, and I mean, you know, we're in this film, we're in a period of heavy censorship in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few things that happen in this part of the film that are very sexy. I mean, you know, we nowadays, you know, if people want to get sexy, they in movies, they just throw somebody down on the ground and show them having sex.
Oh, yeah.
But
oh, believe
at
me,
this point,
she would have they would have been under the sheets by
oh,
this time
yeah.
and
already,
in a modern
yeah.
film. Yeah. Whether she believed them or not.
It'd be 50 Shades of Sheet.
Yeah.
but, you know, at this point, he says, you know, you might as well, you can take off your skirt if you want because it's wet. She says, no, thanks. And she says, but I will take off my stockings. And she starts taking off her stockings and you can see where they're handcuffed together still. And he kind of is like, well, do you want any help with that? And she says, no, thank you. You know, and you've got this whole kind of moment where she's taking, which is a little bit risque anyway, because, you know, thinking about it's the 1930s and they're showing this woman taking her stockings off, you know.
Right.
And then, you know, they decide to go to sleep and end up on the bed. And an interesting point in this, at this point, they were required in the U.S. to have 1 foot on the ground at all times. The man had to have at least 1 foot on the ground at all times. Apparently not the case in the U.K. because I didn't see a foot on the ground.
No.
Even though, of course, there's nothing sexy going on and there doesn't have to have that requirement in the U.S. Apparently in England, they didn't have it.
No, I don't think even, well, they were handcuffs. He couldn't even take his coat off. So,
right. But no foot on the ground. He had his
no.
clothes on, but he didn't have his foot on the ground. And in the U.S., that would have been a big no.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
She wakes up a little bit before he does and manages to wriggle herself out of the handcuff. She goes to try to escape, but I think she overhears a phone call. Apparently, a couple of the guys are downstairs. They've traced them to the inn. And she overhears them talking and mentions the 39 steps and that now that she's with them, we'll have to bring her in too. And suddenly, oh, turns out he's been telling the truth the whole time.
Yep. And what saves him in this moment is the innkeeper's wife.
Yes. How? Go.
Yeah, she overhears them, and you know they're saying they're starting to question the innkeeper, and you know, have you had any people come in tonight? You know, any young couples? And he says, well, as a matter of fact, and in bursts the innkeeper's wife. She says, oh, what are you doing here? What is that you're serving them? And he says, oh, you know, it's alcohol. And she says, how much did they pay for it? Half a crown. She grabs the half a crown and thrusts it back at him and says, get out of my inn. What are you trying to do? Get his clothes down. You won't be telling anybody that you got any alcohol after hours here, and shuts him out. You know, and turns back to her husband and gives him a kiss on the cheek and says, you foolish man, you. What are you doing telling these men about this poor couple that are running away together? You know, try and help them out, you know.
Yep.
And thus, you know, she, with that done and with them safe, then Pamela turns around and sneaks back into the room, settles herself on the...
on the sofa, on the couch.
A chaise something. Or something,
yeah.
At the end,
yeah,
of the
exactly.
Bed, and goes back to sleep.
Yep. When they both wake up, she tells them what had happened and what she heard, and that she believes them now. And so, since no one's looking for her, he sends her into town to try to talk to some British, or not British, Scottish authority or another.
Do they go back to London at this point? Because they're going to, I want to say a circus. It's not a circus the way we think of it. Like, you know, Piccadilly Circus back in the day was like a shopping center. And they, the goal is to meet at this event, but she goes to the police. Is it in London or is it in?
Yeah, you're right. They do go back to London.
Okay. I was thinking they went back to London at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she tries to warn, I guess it was just the police in London,
but they insist that nothing's been stolen. Yeah.
Nothing's been stolen. All our secret documents are laying around, you know, wherever we put them.
Where we
nothing's
leave them
missing.
On the table. They're all still there.
Yep. And so they don't believe her, but of course, as soon as she leaves, they decide that she'll lead them to Hannay, so they let her go. And they meet again at the London, Palladium?
Palladium, yeah.
Palladium, there you go, that sounds better.
Yeah.
Where is it, luck would have it, Mr. Memory's show is playing again.
From the very beginning of the movie.
Exactly. And when the performer is introduced, Hannay recognizes his theme music, apparently, which is some sort of catchy tune that he's been whistling off and on throughout the film. And for some reason, that suddenly clicks in his head that is how they're getting the secrets out of London. They're using Mr. Memory.
Right, because there are no missing documents. And Jordan, who's up in the...
in the box.
Things in the box, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, he sees him kind of exchanging a little nod with Mr. Memory.
Exactly. Yes, all through the opera glass vision, which I really love.
You know, that's so funny. I didn't even think about that, but you're right. It's got the two little circles.
Yes. And again, I mean, this is kind of one of those things that when I was a kid growing up watching, you know, 70s cop shows, I've always saw the binocular vision.
And
yeah, I thought that's
and you
where
think,
it all
ooh,
began.
Wow.
Nope.
You know, the camera's filming through binoculars.
Yeah, no, they did it here with the opera glasses. It was very
right.
Cool. But he goes to the police. The police are you Hannay? Yes, but you have to listen to me. Oh, come with us. You don't want to interrupt these people's entertainment. Let's go. Yeah. And
we're British. We don't want to interrupt anybody.
Yeah, no. But he runs to the middle of the room and screams at Mr. Memory, what are the 39 steps? And Mr. Memory is sort of, it's almost you get the impression it's almost, what do you call it? A hypnotic suggestion,
yeah,
or something. He
hypnotic.
Has to respond, yes. And he starts to tell him that the 39 steps is an organization of spies collecting information on behalf of the Foreign Office of.
And then
Mr. Jordan. Yes. And Mr. Jordan shoots him from the box. And tries to get away. The police, of course, zoom in and catch him. Mr. Memory survives long enough to give the secret formula to Mr. Hannay, who...
the new bombers, isn't it? The new...
Yeah, so it was for a silent aircraft engine.
Completely silent.
Yes.
Mr. Memory, what was the secret formula you were taking out of the country?
Will it be all right me telling you, sir? It was a big job to learn it. The biggest job I ever tackled. And I don't want to throw it all away, sir.
It'll be quite all right.
The first feature of the new engine is its greatly increased ratio of compression, represented by R minus 1 over R to the power of gamma, where R represents the ratio of compression, and gamma, seen in end elevation, The axis of the tube line of cylinder, angle of 65 degrees. Dimensions of cylinders as follows. This device renders the engine completely silent. Am I right, sir?
Quite right, old chap.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I'm glad it's off my mind. At last.
I don't know what necessarily it means, but it's this really fun shot. Mr. Memory either dies or faints away. There's a crowd that comes up. Everyone stands up. Hannay stands up, and you see the shot, and the handcuff is dangling from his wrist, and he just reaches his arm out a little bit, and Pamela's there, and he just sort of takes her hand, and the film closes.
Yeah. I love that, too. I mean, it's another, you're left to imagine what happened, but there's no question that Hannah's been cleared, that he and Pamela, you know at this point that they've fallen in love, and it's just everything's going to work out, right? You know, the foreign secrets were, the secrets to the bomber weren't stolen, so the foreign powers aren't going to win, and even though, but I love it that they don't tell you all of that. They just leave it with them holding hands.
Exactly. Well, I also wonder, too, to me, it was one of these things that, because the handcuff is still on his wrist, dangling from his wrist, it almost gives the impression of, like, is this really the end? I mean, is he really cleared? There's got to be a lot more that goes on after this story. And so it just leaves that little bit of story untold, but you know that is there.
What are you, a pessimist?
A little bit.
I mean, maybe that's, you know, one of the reasons I really see this film, even though technically it's a suspense movie, I really see it a lot as a romance. You know, it's kind of all this crazy stuff happens to this guy, but the end is he meets this girl, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, you know, I'd love it that, you know, in this kind of film, they have just constant action. There's always some kind of suspense going, something, you know, kind of leaving the hero's fate in doubt, but it's all kind of pushing toward this romantic ending.
Mm-hmm. And I just appreciate that it wasn't the, as we were describing, it wasn't the, oh, I believe you now, let's make love. It was
right.
Just this very slow, it was just these people that kind of they're forced to kind of get to know each other. They realize that he's not such a bad guy. He, you know, he's a good guy. He's trying to do right. And yeah, there's just, it is a budding romance and not just a, you know, a flash in the pan in the heat of the adventure sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of the things, I can't talk about this movie without talking about the remake. When I was watching the remake, that is one of the things that does sort of happen in the remake that doesn't happen in this version. You have that moment where the music, it just is almost nauseating. The music soars and they're in the, you know, the inn together. And, you know, there's this dramatic moment and you know that they're like, you know, falling in love, but it's all dramatic and unrealistic. Mm. And I love it about this one, the 1935 version, that you don't have that moment. You don't have a moment where the hero looks at the heroine and all of a sudden music swells, because it's just, that's not how reality is. Not that I'm saying that movies have to be completely realistic, but it's very believable because you don't have those moments where you're like, oh, they're trying to play on our emotions. You know, you have everything about it, and I think we've used the word natural several times, but everything in this movie is very natural. You don't get the impression that they're trying too hard to get a point across, but all of the important points do get made.
Yeah, just the scene that you were talking about at the end when, you know, she admits that she knows he's telling the truth and everything. Well, okay, great. Well, let's get moving. I mean, it's
exactly.
That's what you
Why
wouldn't say,
you
well, great,
earlier?
let's take an hour or two and really get to know each other. No,
right,
that's
right.
Not going to happen. You know, there's people looking for us who want to kill me. I think that
there's
we should move. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I, you know, not to knock the remake of it, but I love that about the original, that it's all, you know, it's well-paced, but then it's also, I completely forget what I was about to say. I love that. I love that about the old one.
It's well paced. It's not exhausting. You don't feel like at the end you're like, oh, what's going on? Who's this? You know, where are we going? Where are we? It's well paced. It's not slow. There's no points where you really think, oh, geez, get on with it.
Right.
I think
all the important questions get answered, but they aren't answered ad nauseum.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some if you want to look at it, is real critical as far as some of the, I don't know even know what you would call it, but like
the technical aspects.
The technical aspects, or the moment when Hannah is shot, and then the next scene is that little almost feels the add in of, oh, have you seen my hymn book? Oh, it was in my coat that you gave to the mm-hmm. guy. And then of course the next scene is, oh, so that almost feels, like I said, almost added in, like, well, maybe it's too much to try to sit there and explain it in the sheriff's office, so let's put this scene in and explain it that way.
From randomly. Yeah,
exactly. Or else you have to have him sitting there, oh, apparently, yeah, I was in a farmhouse and the woman helped me, and the farmer, she gave me her husband's coat. You'd have to have all this dialogue.
Exactly.
And that dialogue would take twice as long as that scene took.
Exactly. But yeah, so they answer all the questions, but without filling in too many details on it.
Yep. But like I said, it was a fun film to watch, and I think I will have to try to find a little bit of a cleaner version somewhere, mm-hmm. and to watch it again, because I'm glad I have it now, because I think I probably will watch it again. I'll probably even share it with a person or two,
yeah.
Because it is this really neat exercise in, okay, you think you know, but here it is. You know, 70 years ago, they were doing the same stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. 70 years later, we have this film that really stands up well. And I mean, well enough, definitely, that they went ahead and remade it.
Yeah, twice, actually, I think. I think they did one in the 50s as well.
I need to look that up. I'm not familiar with that version.
Nope. Well, I wasn't really familiar with this version. 1959. And actually, it looks like there might have been one in the 70s as well.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I definitely recommend the 2008 version. I would say watch the 35 version first, because it's not a modern film. And I'm of the opinion that if you're going to watch two versions of the same film, watch the first one first, the earlier one first, because you're not going to be distracted by the difference in, technology. But I think they're both very respectable films.
All right, very cool. Yeah, I will have to look up the remake. Now that I've seen the original, I would very much like to see the remake and the most modern remake and see how it compares.
Yeah, and, again, I think the characters are great. Rupert Penry-Jones plays Hannah in the new one, and I'm not familiar with this actress, but she's got a great name. Her name is Lydia Leonard.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. but no, they're both very enjoyable. They do a great job. I have to say, I mean, if I could, I love Robert Donat and Madeline Carroll in this film. I think they're just, their interactions are fantastic. Madeline Carroll, again, it's funny because you don't at any point look at her and think she's acting. She never overdoes anything. You never get the uncomfortable reaction shots, where you kind of got the,
right.
Some of the older actresses were prone to. You don't get that from her. She's really an exceptional actress, and you don't feel like she's cheating too much toward the camera. She's doing, it seems, again, hate to use the same word like six times in the same podcast, but it's very natural. She's just a really good actress. And Robert Donat is just, however you pronounce his name, he's really fun to watch. You just feel like if you met him in person, he'd be just a great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And point you made about the not overacting, a lot of the films in the 30s, I mean, especially when you're coming out of the silent era, many of the actors that carried over from the silent era were, for not to put too fine a point on it, an over actor, because you had to be a little over expressive because you didn't have the dialogue to go along with it.
Exactly.
And it was hard for them.
Yeah, you don't get that.
It was hard for them to shake it, and you expect some of that in some of these early talky films, mm-hmm. but no, it is not in this film, and that's what makes it a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and the timing is really good. There is a film out right now about Alfred Hitchcock.
That's right.
With the actor, I can never think of his name.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head. I have no idea. I'm sorry. I can look it up real quick if you like.
Yeah, we could look it up. Either one of us could look it up really quick. Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah, and Helen Mirren.
Helen Mirren.
That's right. And then Scarlett Johansson, I think, is in it too. And you kind of go, what is what part is Scarlett Johansson playing in a film about Alfred Hitchcock? What in the world? She's playing Tepi Hedren. I don't know. Yes. She's probably not. I'm not sure.
No, she's playing Janet Leigh. Actually.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but I believe this film is all about the making of Psycho. Mm-hmm. So rather good timing. We decided on this film before I knew about Hitchcock coming out, but it rather, you know, very timely.
Apropos, yeah. Very appropriate.
So I would I would definitely recommend people check this film out, find it in whatever way they can, and just give it it's actually like about an hour and 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
it's not a lot. Yeah, it's not a great deal of your time to, and I don't think it'll be a waste.
I'm going to say this. I might regret it later. He did one called Secret Agent, 2 years later. It's also got Madeline Carroll in it. I'm not going to tell you watch Secret Agent over the 39 Steps. The 39 Steps, I think, is a little bit kind of more fun-loving, if you can say that about a spy film. But as far as kind of more edge of your seat, kind of, if you're a fan of Hitchcock and in his horror days, I would recommend Secret Agent over the 39 Steps. If you are a fan of, the romantic movies, they're both good. They both have a strong romance going in them. They both have Madeline Carroll in them. But if you're, a bigger fan of the romances, I would say go for the 39 Steps. It's got some kind of more humorous stuff in it. But definitely Secret Agent is also a really stand-up film and is a little bit closer to the suspense and kind of horror side that we're used to with Hitchcock.
Great cast, too. It's got John Gielgud and, Peter Lorre.
Oh, yeah, Peter Lorre in that. Peter Lorre in any movie is, he's creepy.
That makes me really want to see Secret Agent now.
Yeah.
I love Peter Lorre. Help me, Rick!
He is really creepy in this one. There are a couple of characters in it that it just keeps you guessing. So, again, I don't want to get off topic, but, if you're looking for something a little more intense, Secret Agent is great example of Hitchcock when he was kind of moving into that suspense and horror genre.
Well, May, we'll look into that maybe in the future. Maybe we'll review that here on the on Orphan Entertainment.
Yeah, great movie.
If it's available. Yeah, maybe we'll check that one out. But I think that will do it for us. I hope you enjoyed our little discussion about the 39 Steps. We'll be back in about a month with another film. We haven't discussed what that should be yet, but we'll come up with something hopefully good.
Or maybe delightfully horrible. You never know.
Exactly. But no matter what, I'm sure we will have fun with it. Yeah. And thank you all very much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed, and we hope you come back and join us next time. Thanks. Bye.